From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll ride along with a police patrol in a Milwaukee neighborhood that sees many residents incarcerated. Later, work to raise the profile of high school debate in Milwaukee.
I think that we have a lot of activities for our youth in our school systems that are based on athletics, and very few that are based on academic achievement.
A major work by glass artist Beth Lippman goes on public display. And the thrills of being a pro wrestling villain.
When I have a 85-year-old lady with thick glasses flipping me off and telling me how much she hates me, and you know that that's what I like the best.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's great to have you listening today. Wisconsin has the highest incarceration rate of African-American men in the country. Here in Milwaukee, one zip code is especially affected, 53206, on the city's near north side. Nearly 4,000 black men there are or have been locked up. As part of our ongoing Project Milwaukee series on the issue, WUWM's Bob Bach rode along with police patrolling the area, since police decide whom to arrest, the first step towards incarceration. During this part of the ride, Captain Tom Stigler and Sergeant Lewis Statton describe what they see and hear every day that causes them concern.
In that past block, there was six boarded up houses. Yeah, there's another one. In two blocks, we have... There's another one there. Eight boarded up houses plus all the vacant lots. You imagine being one of the citizens that owns a house on this block that's trying to make it work. The houses are literally scavenged for everything scrap metal. They get boarded up, and then they're just magnets for kids to hang out on, and they'll use them as drug houses. Sometimes they'll run extension cords from other houses to put electricity in there. Sometimes they run after-hour bars out of them. Those are illegal taverns that I run out of either private residences or commercial buildings. They're magnets for crime, number one, and they're extremely dangerous. Multiple homicides over the years at these after-hour parties where, you know, there's just uncontrolled liquor being consumed and there's drugs and people have guns. There might be one light in the middle of the basement, say, and, you know, a stripper pole hanging in the corner, and that's all that's going on there. So sometime in the not-too-distant past, every one of these vacant lots was a house that was occupied by a family, a tax-paying family that cared about their neighborhood. We have a very, very low owner occupancy rate in this area. And that leads to some of the problems that you see as we're driving along here. The litter, there's a lot of disorder in this area, and it's our job to try and keep it under control.
Stigler says one technology is helping Milwaukee police respond quickly to troublesome situations. It's called ShotSpotter. Microphones tucked out of sight in high-crime neighborhoods. The system enables officers to almost instantly identify where someone has fired a gun.
On a hot summer night, when there's very little wind, sometimes the officers tell me when they get on the scene that they can still smell the gun smoke in the air. The vast majority of gunshots in Milwaukee... It's a crime to shoot a gun in the city of Milwaukee, but they're not shooting at somebody. They're not shooting at somebody that was breaking into their house. They're not shooting at an opposing gang member or drug member. People just shoot off guns in the city. Sometimes they do it. They buy a gun from somebody on the street, and they want to make sure it works, so they go off the back porch and fire a couple shots into the ground or fire some shots into the air. You know, people are at bar time, they have a gun with them, and they, you know, shoot off guns, or they'll try to shoot out street lights, things like that.
So not to mention this could have a huge destabilizing impact on a neighborhood.
Absolutely. And what we found is that we have made a lot more arrests using the ShotSpotter system in the few years that it's been in existence. because a lot of times people don't call the police when they hear gunshots in their neighborhood. Either they're desensitized to it or they don't want to get involved. So it's helped us help the neighborhoods that really can't help themselves. We've had, you know, neighbors come out and cheer us and say thank you for doing that. You know, that idiot's been shooting off that gun for the last 3 days.
Perhaps you've heard in earlier segments of our Project Milwaukee series, some people insist traffic stops unjustly contribute to Wisconsin's high rate of incarceration among African-American men. Well, Captain Tom Stigler disagrees. Officers in his district pull over a lot of vehicles, but he says the stops result in less crime. Stigler says police are especially vigilant about halting burglaries and auto thefts because they destabilize neighborhoods and demoralize residents.
If
somebody has a 10-year-old car and they have to drive to work every day, say in Brookfield or in Waukesha or on the south side, wherever the jobs are, even if it's down in Menominee Valley, they need that car to get to their job. And when they wake up in the morning and their 10-year-old car is gone, it has a tremendous impact, negative impact on their life. Most of these people do not have a couple thousand dollars laying around to go out and buy another car. The car is probably not insured to be replaced. Likelihood is that they may lose their job on top of losing their car. If there's a burglary, people work hard and they save up money and they buy a big screen TV, and somebody steals a minivan and they park in an alley and they break into that house while that person is at work and they take their TV, has a tremendous impact on the psyche of that family or that occupant. There is nothing worse than being the victim of a burglary. It impacts your whole perception of your neighborhood. It impacts how you sleep at night. So we really try to have an impact on those two crimes. And the best way to impact those two crimes is by conducting traffic stops of people that we think might be involved in auto thefts and or burglaries. And the data has shown that we can have a direct impact on those two crimes by the number of traffic stops. In the last 7 years, we have increased our traffic stops by hundreds of thousands in the city. And the rate of burglary and auto theft has dropped.
Yet, Stigler says most traffic stops result in just a warning to the driver. He wishes more residents understood the police perspective.
It sometimes can get frustrating for law enforcement because we have part of the community coming to us and saying, you need to do something about this problem. And then at the other hand, you have other segments of the community saying, well, you're just targeting them. When we see a group of young black males hanging out on a corner, I expect my officers to engage those young black males. Data shows that frequently those young black males can be engaged in illegal activity. Now, all the time is that true? Absolutely not. But it is my officers' jobs to step up, talk to those citizens, and if they're not doing anything wrong, they'll have a positive interaction with the community and everybody will be on their way. But if somebody is involved in some illegal activity, I expect my officers to take proactive enforcement. Because the people that live on that block, when they try to walk to the corner bus stop, they don't want to walk through that very intimidating group that are probably dealing drugs or they're lookouts for something. And those are the kind of complaints we get, is you have citizens asking for our help to have an impact on these problems, but then at the same time, you're frequently accused of racial profiling or trying to shut down an African-American tavern, when the reality is that's not the case at all. The case is that we are trying to do our job to the best of our ability, because that's what the community asks us to do.
When it comes to arresting black men for drug offenses, Stigler says elected leaders set the rules.
When you talk about drug offenses, do we incarcerate a higher percentage of African-American males in this community than non-African-American males? I don't know. But I think that's what people believe. And I think people are taking a look at that. You know, I think society is changing. I don't think we're sending people to prison anymore for, you know, possession of marijuana or even dealing marijuana, you know. When I was in narcotics, 15 years ago, when you dealt marijuana, it was the same as dealing crack cocaine. It's not perceived the same way anymore. Should it be? You know, that's for society to decide.
Captain Stigler says police actions are stabilizing neighborhoods and residents' quality of life. He says that includes interacting and intervening in order to prevent violence and men going to prison.
If we know, you know, there's repeat violence in a family situation, we try to get those people the resources they need to stop it on their own. But if you have a neighborhood dispute that flares into a neighborhood fight and then there's weapons involved, those are the types of things that it's very hard for police to impact. But what we are trying to do, and we've tried a lot in the last couple of years and we're really going to work hard on it this year again, is the retaliatory violence. So if there is a neighborhood dispute and somebody does get hurt, instead of just letting it sit, we're going to dig down into that incident and try and have an impact on the people that may retaliate. If John Smith got a broken jaw in that fight, and John Smith has got three brothers that are prone to acting out, we need to go out and have contact with those three brothers and say, listen, we got the guy that did this to your brother. He's in jail. It's not going to do you any good to try and, you know, shoot up somebody's house or try and get revenge or retaliate in any way. And that's the type of impact that we're trying to have from this point going forward. But it's difficult. It takes a lot of resources. It takes a lot of investigation on the front end to identify those linkages, as we call them, between the crimes to try and break that cycle of violence.
I tend to try to talk to people on a daily basis, especially when the weather is warm. And when I talk to them, they want to be hopeful that things are getting better, things are changing. So that's the takeaway that I get most of the time.
It's a very small element. Very, very small element of the community that creates the majority of the crime. We always say in Milwaukee, it's 10% of the offenders account for 60% of our violent crime. And the data proves that. Those are the 10% of the people that we try to have an impact on. And I think we are.
Bob Bach, 89.7 WUWM.
You can find links to other features from the series at wuwm.com/Project Milwaukee. Dozens of Milwaukee high school students will argue over Latin American trade policy this weekend. That could mean only one thing, the City Debate League Championship. We'll learn about it when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. We're all aware that a conversation with a teenager can be a contentious one, but the arguments that dozens of teens will get into over the next 2 days in Milwaukee are not only sanctioned, they are encouraged. Teams from around the city will compete this afternoon and all day tomorrow in the Michael Best and Friedrich Milwaukee Debate League City Championship at Marquette University. The teams are brought together under the auspices of the Milwaukee Debate League, a nonprofit group that's worked with high schools and middle schools to develop competitive debate programs. Tim Shalley is an attorney and partner for Michael Best and Friedrich and president of the Debate League. Joni Schmiel is executive director of the league, and they're with us in the studio. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Why does debate make a difference to students and also to the schools they attend?
I think it's a great question. I think, you know, the students that debate, particularly in the urban environment, are students who are looking for the ability to get more in depth with topics. I think that it also helps our students learn research skills. It improves their reading. It improves their ability to analyze data. And so we found that, you know, the students that we have in the program are really benefiting and are more able to be ready for college.
Do they realize that when they get involved in debate, that it's not just going to be arguing that it's going to be research, it's going to be planning things out, it's going to be all of these other things?
I don't think so. I think we trick them. I think we trick them by using this as a game. And it has strategy, just like chess. And so as they learn the components, they become more and more involved in it and then realize later on that they can use those skills in other areas of their life.
Is there a broader impact that goes beyond the student but to the school where they're attending?
I think so. I mean, I think that it changes the culture of a school. I think that we have a lot of activities for our youth in our school systems that are based on athletics and very few that are based on academic achievement. And so I think that having students, particularly in schools that would not have this as an opportunity, be involved in a larger scale program throughout the city does change the dynamic at that school. It's almost like saying that it's cool to be smart.
Explain what the significance of the Milwaukee Debate League itself is. You are not necessarily the coaches at the schools. You're more the organizational aspect to it?
Correct. We are the community partner. We're our own nonprofit, and we come in and we partner with schools, and we ask them to do certain things like provide a coach and stipends and things like that. And then we provide the platform for the tournaments, all the administration, the training for the coaches and the judges. And so, you know, without those partnerships, we would not have a program. Which I think has become increasingly more important for school systems as they've lost resources to have these kinds of activities.
Well, and are you an organizer for purely the city of Milwaukee? Do other debate leagues exist in the suburban communities as well?
They definitely they exist in the suburban communities. I think the difference is that, you know, over the last 20 years, they disappeared from the urban environment. And so, you know, our role is to bring that back. You know, suburban schools tend to have the resources to have these programs. Urban schools don't. And so our focus is on the Milwaukee area. We do have some schools that are a little bit outside of that. Our students do compete at the state level with other suburban schools. But for the majority of our students, they're competing locally because it's what the resources funding has the availability to provide for them.
Most major cities in the United States now have some form of an urban debate league like the one that Milwaukee has. It's been a phenomena of sorts that's really started 15 or 20 years ago, and it's spread throughout the country. There's even a National Association for Urban Debate Leagues that's centered in Chicago that acts as sort of an umbrella organization. It works in conjunction with the local organizations of which Milwaukee is one. And the reason the movement started, well, number one, was to bring the programs back into the urban schools because over time they had disappeared. Some of that's funding, and then there's other reasons for it. But people who have participated in this activity over time, they know intuitively that it's a transformational activity. You learn communication skills. You learn to think critically. It's competitive. And it's an exciting activity. It's a lot of hard work, but at the end of the day, you end up being a much more highly educated person, more articulate, and more academically ready for college. One of the emphasis in the Urban Debate Leagues is certainly to make the program available to everyone in the school system, but in particular to target maybe students who are struggling, kids who are dropping out, who aren't going to school very often, who come from difficult family situations, because the studies have now shown what we always intuitively knew, which is that the gains that are achieved by participating in debate and speech programs are substantial. They're enormous with respect to students struggling at the edge. And there is now – it's proven beyond a reasonable doubt. There's academic peer-reviewed studies that show this. Grade point averages go way up. Kids start going to school. They become excited by the programs for the first time maybe in their lives. They have an adult in a room who is reviewing their arguments and actually listening to them. And their college test scores increase. Their high school graduations rates skyrocket and college entrance acceptance rates skyrocket. So we've got a great thing here. I mean, it's really beyond dispute that it's really a transformational activity. And we want to make it available widely in our Milwaukee school system.
Walk us through how a debate competition actually works.
Well, we practice a specific kind of debate, and it's called Policy Switch Side. And so they have a topic that they stay on for the whole year. It's a public policy topic. This year was based on Latin American trade. And so the students have case files. They go through that process. They come to the tournament ready to debate for at the high school level, three rounds for an hour and a half. And then there's about a 15 to 20 minute review with the judge. At the middle school level, it's about 45 minute rounds. We do those at four rounds through the day.
Well, and what goes on in a round?
Well, what they do is they find out which side they're going to argue about 5 minutes before their round. So either they're going to be affirmative or they're going to be negative. What's unique about that is they have to be able to argue both successfully. So they may not agree at all, but they have to present their arguments based on evidence. It's not really conjecture. It's not really rhetoric. It's really about having evidence that proves their argument. And so they go through a series of arguments. There's a rebuttal, you know, basically a series of eight speeches. And then at the end, the judge gives them feedback and tells them, you know, which side was more convincing.
And are they teams or individuals?
They're teams. So they're teams of two. So they would have another team of two that they're competing against from another school. You know, at a typical debate tournament, you know, we have one adult to every four kids because we needed a judge in the room for every four kids, which I think is a really unique part of this activity. I mean, that to have an adult listen to you for an hour and a half throughout the day and give you focused feedback and really be interested in helping you develop your argument as you move through the day is a critical part of the program and invaluable.
This is a pretty high pressure sounding environment to be to be one of two people on a team and be responsible for debating something over the course of an hour and a half multiple times over the course of a day.
It's intense. It's incredibly intense. You know what's interesting though is that you know you would expect I think more rivalry than there is. I mean, the kids have learned how to conduct these very intense arguments and then come out and congratulate each other and learn from each other and learn from each other's coaches. And so I think that, you know, although it is a high pressure activity, we're also teaching some skills on how to cope in that kind of environment and how to conduct yourself in a way that's appropriate.
The more of this you do, the more exciting it becomes. And it does get to the point – I mean, this is an activity that I participated in high school – where you want to go to the next tournament. You want the next round. You want the tournament to go another round so that you can make your arguments and keep testing yourself. The students spend a lot of time on this. There's really no end to how much research you can do. There's no end to how many different interpretations of the annual resolution there is. There's no end then to the number of rebuttal arguments there could be. It's really a process of thought development. So they're spending a lot of time during the week. They're researching. They're reading law review articles in many cases. They're reading the major newspapers. They're reading government documents. They're constructing their arguments. And then they're getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning on Saturdays to go to these tournaments, which are typically held on weekends. And they spend their entire day on Saturday. And sometimes it's Friday, Saturday, and sometimes Friday, Saturday, Sunday, depending on the type of tournament, arguing with other students similarly motivated. They're not at home watching television. They're not out on the street. They're not doing all sorts of other things. It's an amazing dedication that you eagerly buy into once you have had a chance to participate in the activity.
You essentially have a group of high school students who are spending their whole Saturday debating Latin American trade policy.
That's exactly what's
correct.
Happening.
I think about my own two kids who are younger than this league takes into account, but I just think about how they approach the world, and I wonder, are young people predisposed to being good at debating?
Well, if you have children, you already know.
So you know.
You know, it could be good or bad for a parent if they have a child that debates. My child did for a bit, and she tried to use those skills on me. You know, I think it's critical thinking skills that they're developing in a different way, which I think that as they go through and they start to try to process what they're seeing in the media and, you know, in government, they're able to see these in a different light. You're using those skills in a way that you can think critically about the argument. You can see from another point of view that I think is valuable. I think, you know, teenagers like to hear themselves talk, but I think more importantly, they want to be heard. And so often, you know, in our society, they're kind of, you know, marginalized. I think that most kids desperately want that kind of interaction with positive adults in their life to help guide them and help them make decisions that, you know, they may think they're absolutely right today. But having a thoughtful conversation allows them to think outside of their original point, which could help, you know, in a more serious conversation that a parent might have.
Well, thank you to both of you, and thanks so much for sharing the story of the Milwaukee Debate League.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Joni Schmiel is executive director, and Tim Shalley is president of the Milwaukee Debate League. The league's 2014 City Championship is this afternoon and all day tomorrow at Marquette University. You'll find a link to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Wisconsin glass artist Beth Lippman talks about one of the largest pieces she's ever created when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Tyke. Beth Lippman is an internationally known glass artist who does her work in a home studio in Sheboygan Falls. Her work is in museums and galleries around the country. But her most recent large-scale work is currently on display right here in Wisconsin at the Museum of Wisconsin Art in West Bend. Lake Effect Bonnie North traveled to the museum recently to chat with her and with Director of Collections Graham Reed. Standing directly in front of the piece, Lippman describes the work.
This piece is called Sideboard with Blue China, and it's about a 25 or 26 foot long installation. This is the Horicon Bank Gallery.
It's the Horicon Bank Gallery. Yeah. The piece is on what we call the One Gallery. So it's on a balcony that's about 8 feet wide, and the piece is about 11 feet tall, about 25 feet long. And one of the things that we were just talking about that makes the installation of this piece particularly interesting in the museum is that depending on what time of day you come to see it, the piece will actually look slightly different because it has natural light, artificial light, and then, of course, the natural light shifts throughout the course of the day. So it actually, I mean, even as we're just standing here, the sun's coming out a little bit, and it's just, it really does, it changes right before your eyes.
Yeah, it changes colors, even though the glass is essentially clear,
right. But
you can see, like, the spectrum of light come through it, which is really cool.
Yeah. I mean, I most likely will not be able to see it in this kind of venue again, truly. So it's really a pleasure to see this. It really completely highlights the different qualities of the material, the refractive and the reflective qualities.
It's incredibly complex. You've got lots and lots of different things. I mean, that's sort of a hallmark of your work, is layers upon layers upon layers of things. What were you thinking about when this project first came to your mind? What were you trying to explore?
Well, I knew for a while that I wanted to tackle making a sideboard because of the history of the sideboard being used as a symbol of, you know, the hunt and the wealth of the individuals, the domestic environment. The symbolism is really quite interesting for me. But I wasn't quite sure exactly what to do until recently. So in this particular piece, what I did was I combined this historical understanding of sideboard as a presentation and also a vanity piece for displaying what we consume. And I also depicted things that are aspects of ourselves. So it's really a portrait a composite portrait of things we consume and also ourselves. It's a bit of a shrine, in my opinion. It's also a personal piece for me. There's a lot of personal symbolism, but we have, just for an example, on the sideboard, we've got a kind of Chinese-inspired vessel. We've got a heart, lungs, brain, bird of prey. We've got sea life and a uterus. We've got, in the center, there's a his and her panel. So to the left of the female panel is the male panel with birds. It's kind of a hunting scene, which was also something very typical that you would find. And then we've got intestine, stomach, feet, wheat, corn. And then the flanking panels on the end are kind of supportive roles, in my opinion. We've got, to the right, we've got snakes, eggs, butterflies for the cycle of life, reincarnation, lots of symbolism there. And to the left, we've got symbols of faith and loyalty. The dog, for instance, surrounded by flowers. Yeah, we have like a Whippet-inspired...
Oh, yeah, there it is. Yeah.
Dog and some hands. So, you know, it's just kind of an exploration of the meeting of all of these images and symbols.
The sideboard is what you said, Graham, like 25 feet long.
It's not just the sideboard. They're actually Beth refers to as wallpaper.
I was just going to ask about those. Yeah, it goes onto the wall as well.
Which is actually thin glass. It's basically trees and boughs and almost what look like almost palm fronds. And those are actually very slender, slim pieces of glass which are actually stuck on the wall like wallpaper. So the whole piece, I think, from one end to the other is about 25 feet.
Mm-hmm. The sideboard itself is about 16 feet. So the wallpaper brings this thing that is primarily of an interior space, a domesticated object, to the outside, so it kind of mashes up once again this idea of interior, exterior, so we're kind of marrying all of these different things together. And it also is in keeping with the tradition of historic wallpaper, for instance, of Zubair, the Zubair Company of France. You would find a lot of exotic landscape, handmade papers in the 18th century as well as afterwards. So it is in keeping with a form of deck arts, but it's kind of taking it. I've appropriated its use.
What I love about your work, as we were talking about at the beginning, is just those multiple layers and layers and layers of things. And you can stand in front of one panel, and what I've been doing is I've been kind of letting my eyes unfocus so that I can just sort of see what comes to the surface for me, and it changes as I look at things. And that's just one panel. And then there are many, many, many bits to look at, all and different textures, too. You know, you've got the clear glass and what looks like blown, but you've also got this. And what is that technique?
So I've used a variety of different techniques in this piece. And also, I would like to give a shout out to Stephen Deers, who made the wood frame for the piece as well. But there's casting as well as sculpting, blowing, lamp working, fusing, slumping in this piece. So the piece that you just pointed out, Bunny, is basically a cast form. It's a triangular, what I call kind of a supportive role to this main center medallion. And that is actually clear glass that's been crushed to a very fine powder. And when you fuse it, it doesn't ever come completely back up to a pure kind of transparent clear glass. So you get something that's almost more stone-like.
Yeah, it almost looks etched.
So that's a surface, you know, that's an investment process where you make these molds, put them in kilns, and fire them at a high temperature. So it is a different aesthetic than some of the more fluid approaches with, you know, the sculpting. And
is that like a Lalique, type of glass would look like
Lalique uses, tended to use that. Some artists that really champion kiln casting in a contemporary fashion are the Czech artists. Have a long history of making incredible sculptures in glass using casting as well.
So how long did it take you to make this piece? Because I've seen your shop, and it's pretty large, but this is, and as you say, there are so many different techniques that you used. You had to be doing things at different times.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I could have used a lot longer to make this piece than I had. I'll put it that way. I mean, it took about 10 months, which for a piece this size, I mean, this is probably the largest piece I've made, definitely the most complex. It was a bit of a rush, but I made it for my first solo exhibition at Claire Oliver Gallery in New York, and that was the time frame that was allotted. So I worked with, it took a village, it really took a village to make this piece. Lots of really super talented people pulled together to help me. And I really enjoy working in that way because I enjoy the expanded vocabulary of having other people's hands in the work as well.
So what did people do?
Well, for instance, I had my dear friend Emma Stein help me in the hot shop. She would either assist me making things or I'd assist her making things sometimes. Jeremy Popelka, Stephanie Trenchard, also a very well-known Wisconsin-based artists, incredible. They helped me in their facility quite a bit creating work. There's a lot of help with the castings after I made the initial positive. There's a lot of investment that needed to be made. So I worked with some people from Stevens Point. University of Stevens Point allowed me to use their kilns on the off season, which totally saved my hide. I mean, I never would have gotten the piece finished without that. So I really am indebted to a lot of people, including my husband, Ken Sager, who's fabulous. Helped me in every aspect.
It so, sounds like you, yeah, thanks to the entire state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And out. And ripple effect out.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is what happens when you work in this material. I mean, even as you know, just from a preliminary experience, I mean, it's not like painting where you go into your studio, close the door, and have a private experience. And I think I actually might have said that the last time I talked with you. It is something that is a more collaborative effort, which is, it's interesting. I mean, it's one of the things that make us human, right, is this eusocial kind of experience where we're all helping each other for a common end.
It took about 3.5 days to actually install the piece, and that was with three to four people working on it much every day. To
variety
there's
of
no
curse
way
words
that,
occasionally.
There's no way that one person could actually install this. I mean, absolutely physically no way.
Yeah. Well, and I love that idea of the collaborative because, you know, like you said, it takes a village. It took, you know, lots and lots of different people. But I think that also informs the art that we're looking at, too. You know, it's not just that all these people helped, but that it does reflect us in a different way than, say, a piece that you did completely by yourself might.
That's right. That's right. And I find it always fascinating and also humbling the amount of ownership people take over what they're doing. I mean, yes, I've paid people to help me, but I've also had people just help me out of the, you know, their interest in what I've been doing. So I'm super fortunate in that I think the work is resonating to a broader audience, and that's like the first stop on the journey is seeing, okay, what does this student think of this work that they're donating X number of hours to just come help out?
What was the response?
Well, they kept coming back, so I guess it was okay. I think people do get invested and they read, you know, the narrative is different for everyone, but everyone creates their own story about what each of these parts mean to them, and that also feeds me in turn. So it's a really interesting cycle that keeps the work alive.
Beth, as always, such a pleasure.
Oh,
and
thank you
so much for stopping
in
to do this. And Graham, thank you very much for hosting us on the day the museum's closed.
You're always more than welcome.
Thank you. Thanks much, Bunny.
Glass artist Beth Lipman's latest large-scale work, Sideboard with Blue Glass, is on display at the Museum of Wisconsin Art through April 13th. She and Director of Collections Graham Reed spoke with Bonnie North right there at the museum. From the sublime to the more ridiculous, one last break, and then we'll learn about the heyday of pro wrestling in Milwaukee, at least from the perspective of one former villain. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
that one full of excitement and satisfaction. People come from miles around to watch the action.
Like Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Until sports such as mixed martial arts supplanted it, professional wrestling was one of the most popular spectator and televised sports in the country. Some sports fans might quibble with that distinction, saying the scripted matches required no skill, but our next guest would disagree. Milwaukee native Chris Malterer, known as Chris Curtis in wrestling, spent more than 25 years in the ring, competing largely in the Midwest against some well-known opponents, including national names like Hulk Hogan and Jesse Ventura. He's been retired for a decade, but recently wrote a book about his time in wrestling. Job Man, My 25 Years in Professional Wrestling, was co-written by local author Larry Wyden. Malterer tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North what the term job man even represents.
That's a wrestling term that's used throughout the business. And so that's what we did. We went out, we did a job for a guy and put him over, made him look good. And you don't make yourself look good, you make him look good. Although in the process of doing all that, we make ourselves look like we're professionals too.
Well, but you were a professional.
Correct, yes. And we're out there to make wrestling look believable, even though it's not. And so when I was in the ring, I made sure that when I was doing my job, making the star look good, I made sure everything was crisp, it was tight, and...
And that the audience bought it.
Right. That's the biggest thing. You have to make sure that the audience bought it, because if something was off a little bit, and it happens, they catch on real quick. And so you have to sometimes ad lib, and, you know, it's, you're on the spot. There's no do-overs out there, so, yeah.
Well, talk a little bit about that kind of agreement that the audience has with professional wrestling. I mean, people know on some level, I think that it's, I don't want to say not real, because you're actually out there doing things and right. You're making it work, but you're not fighting to the death, literally.
Correct. We're out there basically working a play. That's what we're doing. There's two athletes that are working a play, and there's a start of the play, there's the middle of the play, and then there's the finish, the ending of the play. But while we're out there, you have to make sure you keep those people guessing, even though there's people out there that say, well, no, this is not on the up and up. It's not on the level. You still keep them guessing, and that's why you go all out, but you're not out there to hurt your opponent.
So, right. What I like about it is that it's very much theater.
Correct. And if we were actually out there trying to hurt each other, there would be no professional wrestling. The business would be dead. It would be gone, because there would be nobody left. What we do is we work a match, and it goes on to the next week and the next week and the next week, and you keep building on that every single week, day, month.
So the story gets added to?
The story gets added to it, and there's just so many different levels that you can carry it on to. It's kind of like a flower. It blooms, and it gets bigger and bigger, and, you know, finally the flower can't go anymore, so you start with something new, and just before that ends, so.
One of the things that you also do in pro wrestling is you have characters that are in this play. So talk about your character, Chris Curtis.
My main thing, I was the heel. I was the villain. It came natural to me, because when I was a kid, for whatever reason, I was always obnoxious and getting into trouble. Not serious trouble, but just obnoxious trouble. And I would go out in the ring and bait the crowd, do whatever I could to get them riled up. And while I was working the babyface, the good guy, a heel is out there to make the babyface look strong. We're basically the weaker, and so that's why we resort to cheating and underhanded tactics, because we can't legitimately overtake them. So many times, too, the good guy, the babyface, would be the very muscular, stronger, better looking, that type of thing, the more athletic, where a heel was not as built as they were, but we still are very good athletes. Our job was to get the ire of the crowd.
Well, I've looked at some of the pictures in the book, and I have to say, you know, in your younger days, you could have certainly been a baby face if you'd wanted to. You look sort of angelic with your curly hair. You know, you had just like these nice expressions and everything. Mm-hmm. So did you use that to make people think you were something different than the heel that you were in this character?
You know, I never really thought about that. I just went out there and I was just being me. And I never over-exaggerated because people can sense that. That's the way the business is nowadays. You get a lot of guys, they over-exaggerate their mannerisms. I never did that. I just went out there and did what I had to do. And you just, you know, I could just look at somebody and really tick them off. So it was a thing where I guess I just used my natural good looks to tick off people.
And you also, one of the things that was just, I have to say, I sort of shuddered as I was reading the book, was the list of injuries that you sustained doing all of this, doing your job as the job man and making these guys look good. My goodness, rotator cuff, knees, concussion, what else?
I broke my hand. I tore my rotator cuff wrestling Victor the Bear. That was before I got into wrestling. I would have to tape my knees up. I probably dislocated my kneecaps completely at least a dozen times. I bruised my kidneys, had a couple concussions, split my head open probably a dozen times, that kind of stuff.
And is that typical for anyone who's in this business?
More often than not, it's usually knee injuries or hip injuries. A lot of the old timers now, they've had hip replacements, knee replacements. They've had their discs in their back fused. A lot of them are in wheelchairs, walkers. I'm lucky. I didn't end up like that. But those guys also wrestled 7,000 to 10,000 matches throughout their career, and they were in the business 35 to 40 years. So they did it full time. I did it part time. So 700 matches to 800 matches is still a lot. But I'm still pretty healthy. My knees are bad. They're getting a little worse now. So, but you had to go out there. You had no choice. If you didn't work, you didn't get paid. So if you hurt, you had to deal with it.
How did you train and learn how to do the falls and how to do the kinds of things you did in the ring to not really hurt each other, but to make it look like you were?
I actually went to a training camp for about 3 months down in a – used to be a little pool room on 2nd off of National. Guy had a ring set up. And we learned how to work holds. We learned how to fall correctly without hurting ourselves. We learned how to flip, learn how to go over the top rope, that kind of thing. The most important part about falling is tucking your head, protecting the back of your head. And so you do this continually 5 days a week over a 3-month period, and that's what I did. Then you learn how to work a match and so forth. It's all on the job training. But yeah, it takes a long time to make sure that you know how to fall, because you land the wrong way, especially on your neck or the back of your head, and you could be crippled for life.
Yeah, or die.
It's happened.
Yeah.
So.
Now, when you talk about, you know, working a match, in the book you talked about meeting up with the superstars that you were jobbing for and talking about what you were going to do. Was that always the case? You talk ahead of time and like, okay, this is the story and this is how we're going to do it. You knew the moves and that sort of thing?
Yeah. A good example would be like Greg Gagne. I wrestled Greg in the AWA probably a couple dozen times. Basically what you would do, and I'm using him as an example, you meet up beforehand. They tell you how many minutes you're going to go. You might go 10 to 12 minutes. You work out possibly a beginning, what you're going to do, a couple of high spots. And a high spot, Bonnie, is when you see the guys hit the ropes back and forth. That's called a high spot. And then you always come up with a finish. You don't want to go over too much because the crowd might not be buying what you're doing. So the heel, which would be me, we would always, you know, if I had to improvise, I would do that. The heel always called the match in the ring. So if you have the guy in a headlock, basically you're almost a ventriloquist because you talk to the guy and you try not to move your lips. And so you basically go over everything and you see how the crowd reacts. But yeah, you always come up with a little something beforehand. Sometimes there were situations where if you were in a certain town, and you had a baby face dressing room and a heel dressing room that was completely on the opposite side of the auditorium or whatever the case may be, you called everything in the ring. And so that was it. The finish, what would happen would be usually the referee would give you the finish when you get in the ring while you're waiting for the other guy, because the booker of the territory would give the referee the finish, and then from there you would just work something out in there.
To get to that finish.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and then we would call it. So it's not as easy as it looks. You got to make sure that it comes off right. Otherwise, if it falls apart, it's not a good situation.
Well, not only do you have to, you know, make a scenario that works for the two of you, but you've got to get the crowd believing you too.
Correct. And there's certain things that you also do. You have different matches in the card. You have the opener and you have an added attraction and a special attraction and a semifinal and a main event. You're not going to give everybody everything in an opening match. I worked a lot of opening matches, and I loved it because it's my job, it's our job to get the crowd warmed up. So you're going to give them a few things, and then the next match will give them a little bit more, and then the match after that's going to give them more, and then the main event gives them pretty much everything. So it's all a matter of what they're going to buy.
But that's your skill. I mean, you have to be able to turn on a dime.
Exactly. And that's the thing. You cannot be afraid of the audience. You have to be in control of the crowd. If you're not in control of the crowd, you're going to freeze up and it's going to be a disaster. Being a heel, we have a different personality than the good guy, the baby face. We have to go in there with that devil-may-care personality that I'm in charge, you're not, and that's that. And you're going to buy what we're doing, and if they don't like it, I'm going to get on the audience, and they might start responding, but we're the ones who control everything.
Villains are always more fun to play.
Oh, yeah. I was a natural. I mean, I've worked as a babyface before. It's okay, but that's not me. I'm the antagonist. That's what I like the best. So when I have a 85-year-old lady with thick glasses flipping me off and telling me how much she hates me, and you know that...
You've won.
Exactly.
Yeah, you made it. Mm-hmm. Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing a little bit of your very colorful past with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Chris Malterer, known to wrestling fans as Chris Curtis, is the author of Job Man, My 25 Years in Professional Wrestling, co-written by local author Larry Wyden. Malterer will body slam, or at least sign, copies of his book on Monday evening at the Wauwatosa Public Library. He spoke with Bonnie North. That's Friday's edition of Lake Effect, produced by Dan the Hammer Harmon, Stephanie Buzzsaw Lecce, and Bonnie the Monster from the North. I'm Mitch, the human exfoliator Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be able to tune in tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Have a great weekend. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.
Kevin Sullivan, temper like Annabin, purple haze, the man is in a daze. Road Warrior, Midnight Express, somebody said the rock and roll is the best. I don't know the reason they don't have a season. It's not fake or a joke. It's my favorite sport. I'm talking wrestling. Live at the Coliseum, WrestleMania, you gotta go see him. Wrestling. Live at the Orange Bowl, suplex, face shot, sleeper hole, power drop.